Welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, the podcast that eats its young. Hello and welcome to, what's this podcast called again?
It's called The Gambling Files.
Oh yeah, welcome to that. I'm your co-host, John Bruford, and I'm joined by, what's your name again?
Fintan Costello.
Whoa, what a time to be alive. Are we alive?
Very much so.
I agree. And you know, I'm just enjoying being alive today. I had a terrible night's sleep. Really, it was terrible.
No.
Yeah, I know. And I'm one of those people where like bad night's sleep affects everything. Sorry, what were you saying?
No, I was interrupting your story. You've clearly got a story. I was going to go on.
No, it's not. It's not really a story. It's just a bad night's sleep just affects everything.
So I was going to say, was it the change of chief whip in the Conservative Party in the UK that kept you awake all night? Was that the?
I think I felt a disturbance in the force. The kind of disturbance that only an incident to the Conservative Party can really create. And then this morning, my hunch, not in the style of Notre Dame, but my hunch was proved correct in that I saw the news. I saw it in the Compliance and More newsletter this morning. Was it a Compliance and More newsletter this morning?
Yeah, it was.
Okay, great. Because I get my newsletter names mixed up, as I've proved in the past. Saw that. For fuck's sake! it's almost like, you know, one, you look at career politicians and you think to yourself, they're just pretending to be fucking stupid, because nobody's that dumb. And I've been saying the same kind of thing for decades. Nobody's that stupid. Nobody would seriously try and sell this or that or access to this, really, in full knowledge that newspapers are just waiting for them to prove their stupidity. And every single government that comes along proves me completely wrong and proves that they are, in fact, fucking idiots.
So for those not in the details, particularly our international listeners in America and all over the world.
We've got a listener in Mexico now. Make sure they know.
Of course you do. Boom. It's a growth market. There's a member of parliament, so politician in the ruling party, who is also the chief whip, which is kind of like the chief person in charge of getting MPs to vote a certain way or whatever. And he's been caught in a sting operation run by the Times of the UK Times newspaper. And he has promised things like, hang on a second, what was he promised? So he was filmed on camera. So Scott Benton, MP. They set it up that they were like a fake international gambling investment firm or something like that. So he promised them things like access to the gambling white paper 48 hours ahead of publication, offered to submit questions on their behalf, boasted of his easy access to ministers, and said MPs who accepted corporate hospitality were normally willing to submit a parliamentary question on the company's behalf. Now, since the news broke, he's lost his position as the whip. He's also come out in his own defense saying, yeah, it didn't feel right, and I self-reported myself to the whatever, and things of this. But yeah, it's just
fucking stupid.
It is. It's greedy and silly.
He's also...
Wait, you know what? annoys me? You know what annoys me, right? It's okay, so the corruption annoys me, right? So the corruption, and like, you're an elected representative, you're meant to represent your constituents and do the best job for them. That's annoying. Do you know what's also annoying? It's bad corruption, right? So if you
Yeah, it's
are going to
crap
be
at
a
it.
corrupt, if you are going to be a corrupt politician, there's much better ways to do this where you don't get caught in a sting operation.
It's
Like,
all about the money.
just watch any mafia TV, like watch The Sopranos, watch The Godfather. Just like, it's fair. You have a cutout, so they have to contact this other consultancy firm, and everything's done through that, and everything's done arm's length. Like, it's just shitty corruption as well, which just shows how confident and lazy and stupid they also really are. If you're going to be corrupt,
Did I mention they were fucking idiots?
they really are. It's ludicrous.
But the other thing about this is, and this is the part that I think is quite hilarious, he's also dobbed in all of his mates.
Oh, he's dropped everybody in it.
What a
So,
cretin.
if you take the so there was that listener who emailed us about the former minister taking like rugby tickets like the
No,
week
God,
after he
yeah.
stepped down from his role over. So all of the corporate hospitality stuff's on a database, and he's basically said everybody who's taken corporate hospitality from the gambling industry is corrupt, is effectively what he said.
Well, if you're doing follow-up stories, you are now going to be reviewing what those, because politicians don't pose a lot of questions
Oh, exactly.
in
You'd do a
government,
cold
so
correlation between,
easy to find.
you'd look at the corporate hospitality received, looked at the questions submitted,
Piece
and
of
you can do a
piss.
whole thing.
Absolute piece of piss. Like, even I could manage that, and I'm a piss poor journalist on my best day. So it blows my mind. It's like you say, it's really lazy. The other part of this is somebody who is in a position of tremendous influence and privilege, right? And he hasn't even done the fucking due diligence to see if these people are real.
Exactly. Like,
What a
how,
penis.
if you can't spot a fake LinkedIn profile, are you really trying? It is staggering.
It's disappointing. You'd at least expect it to be some, tangled web with offshore shell companies and all kinds of weird shit going on, and these arcane things where you read the story and you don't understand it. But
There
no.
was no drugs. There was no drugs. There was no booze. There was no like honey trap. It was just a straight up lunch or whatever it
Nobody
was. Like, it was just
was even dressed up as though they were from the Middle East.
he can't even say he had like 10 pints and he was
No titty bars, nothing.
Nothing. Just straight up like
It's how easy it was.
here's the shopping list. Pick what you want.
It's, oh man. And it's like,
I'm offering a two for one on ministers. That's
people are like, well, what do you think of the government, John? Well, my thoughts on the Conservative government. I mean, I'm not big on politicians anyway. They're mostly self-serving cretins, as opposed to what they should be, which is public servants. But my thoughts on this Conservative government came about, I think it was, do you know, I can't remember who was Prime Minister because we've gone through so many. But there was an election, and as soon as they got back in, it's like in the States, like the outgoing president always puts through a load of bills that make him look really, really good, so the next dude looks really, really bad when he kicks him out.
Sure.
Which it is kind of hilarious because you see him doing the shit he should have been doing anyway right at the end of a term, just so the next dude looks like a bigger asshole than he probably is.
But it's also a legacy. It's also a legacy thing as well, because you're always remembered for the last stuff you do. So they're also setting up their own legacy of leaving on a high,
Nobody remembers
because then
shit.
you get that speaking gig money. That's the trick, right? That's where the real dough is. A
I
million quid
don't
a pop to go in and chat to Goldman Sachs for an afternoon, right?
know. I
Easy.
could totally do that. Just walk in. You're a turd. You're a turd. You're a turd. But so the first thing they did when they sat back in power, you know, after that first election that confirmed we were all doomed, was they cut benefits to disabled people absolutely to the bone. And these are the benefits that basically allow disabled people the opportunity of a life with parity to those that are able-bodied. Really simple shit. And they just fucking cut the lot to the bone. And there's that wonderful quote, which is, you can truly judge a society by how it treats its most vulnerable people. And that just said everything to me. You know, the Conservatives are in power and remain in power because, A, Labour's had a lack of a half-decent leader for some time. But, B, it's historical voting. And that kind of blows my mind as well. It's like, why don't we just do a bit of homework and vote for who we believe is right, rather than, you know, my parents have always voted Tory because the Labour does this, that, and the other. Well, I'm not necessarily a Labour voter. Not necessarily, you know, I am what you might call a floating voter, and I'll vote for the person that I believe will do the best work for the best reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my fault that that's never a Conservative. Because the Conservatives do shit like this. I mean, God, it's a bit of a piss boiler for me. And it was actually the first thing I read this morning was Compliance and More. Now, there's a great plug for you. And reading that, I was still in bed at the time. I'm lying in bed and I'm just like, oh, you've got to be fucking joking me. Because yet again, the industry's critics are being handed the bat, and then we go, oh no, hang on, could I just take that bat back for a moment? I need to put some nails into the end of it. And then we put the nails in the bat, and then we give it back to him and go on and crack on. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, it's also bad for it's really bad for the gambling industry, because what'll have to happen now is to be deemed, well, let me rephrase that. What you would assume has to happen now, to be deemed credible, the government now has to overreact, and maybe some of the stuff that we're going to pull back on or not do or whatever. I think this creates a situation where they've got to dial it up to 10.
Here's the other part of it, though. And I know this is something that has like historically always happened as long as there have been governments. But it also suggests that, you know, the industry's been trying to curry favor by giving people gifts and shit.
And every industry does that.
I know that. But not every industry gets the kicking that ours does. And again, all we're doing is we're giving people the ammunition. Well, I'm not saying that there's a, you know, we can't give it a, oh yeah, but so and so does it as well. We've got to have some answers to what's coming.
It is true. So it's completely normal for the gambling industry to lobby government. Right?
Totally. But that's why we've got the mighty Betting and Gaming Council. Can't wait to see what they're going to say about this. Fuck. You know what's going to be? It's going to be press release coming out saying that they fully support the Times' thing. It was their idea all along, and they're using it to root out corruption in the industry or some shit like that.
No, they'll just round up all the numbers to make themselves look better.
Round it down to one politician.
It's only one bad apple. The rest of them are great, lads. They're decked out in their rugby merch.
they do their appearances on the news with signed rugby shirts behind them, and you know, little statues of horses with "thanks for all the help."
The Paddy Power lucky underpants and stuff framed on the wall. But it's so yeah. Look, the industry is perfectly entitled and should be lobbying the government. How the politicians respond to that is very much a judgment on their character. there can be sound economic cases for why certain legislation should be, you know, you can, in a normal functioning democracy, that's totally fine, and a good politician should be listening to both the industry and anti-gambling people, and just, like, you know, their actual constituents, right? Which is the key thing. Like, what does it mean for their constituency? Because all politics is local, right? So I get that bit. The fact that he was so blatantly for sale calls into question everything. So you could see a few scenarios. You could see, like, the Conservatives go, this doesn't matter, crack on with what we're doing, and release the white paper. It could be another excuse to delay it another 6 months, which should probably be the right thing. That's probably the political answer. Just kick it down the road. Or, right, this is going to lose us votes and we need to be seen to be tough on whatever and do that. My guess is just kicking it down the road is probably actually what's going to happen.
That is their style.
But hang
on,
wait for a better news cycle to do it.
But there's also, and let's face it, this isn't that likely, but there's also the potential for a parliamentary review into the process of gift acceptance and all of that jazz. I mean, I know they're supposed to declare things and all of that sort of thing, but it might call into play a review of what they're actually allowed to accept, which will change how lobbying works.
It's not going to change how lobbying works.
No. But it will change the transparent part, that part that they have to report.
No. They'll still report it, or they just won't visibly. Like, if you're corrupt, like, there's way better ways to be corrupt than taking rugby tickets. Like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, but we've definitely established that they're not very good at being corrupt.
So you would imagine, but even if there is some sort of inquiry into the whole thing, then that also just delays it by infinite, right? So it just kicks it down the road another fucking 3 years. And then there's a change of government, and then blah, 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 there's elections, and it just gets lost and nothing happens.
I bet his phone's going nuts this morning. People are saying, I've got fucking tickets for the Fury fight, you cock.
Can't go now.
I'm going to have to scalp them.
This weekend? When's the Grand National? Soon?
I don't know. I'll ask the Duke. He'll know.
The 15th. Yeah, there'll be a lot less politicians at Aintree this year. I think that's going to be...
Or will there? Maybe they'll just come out in a show of solidarity.
Top hat and tails. Let's do it. So, what else is going on?
Well, that's a great question. Other than that, I don't think there's that much going on. What have I seen today? I saw G3. G3's done one of their round tables. Anyway, they get a few people chatting about stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's about where you want ICE to be. So that's still ongoing.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, part of me is like, yeah, let's just keep it in London. But then all those European companies are like, it's kind of expensive for us now. But I'm thinking it's probably going to stay in London. I think it should go to Madrid, but I think it will stay in London.
That's interesting.
Especially with the Elizabeth line. I think it's a game changer. Yeah, having done it this year, 40,000 people this year, which is more than ever before, you know, something is going right. And I do think the Elizabeth line, it opens up the city for people. Cheaper accommodation. I stayed in a real shithole, but it was very cheap. I don't know. I mean, you move a show that size, obviously, like, how it's put together and all of that. I mean, it's established over years of frankly genius. And I'm not just saying that because I work with Greg and Kate. Maybe there's a little bit of bias in there. But, moving a show that size into a new venue, and it's also a very different – the Madrid venue is a very different layout. It's a totally different sort of setup. Yeah. My favourite thing about the Madrid venue is that there's a really nice park next door.
That's nice.
It's a massive park. It's got loads of sculptures in it. It's got a golf course in it. I've been running around the park and I haven't found the golf course yet. It must be fucking massive.
How big's the
park? Mind you, that's the thing. See, I went for a run in Ljubljana once, and I went to this park, and like Ljubljana's like the same size as Norwich, or it would be if it didn't have the world's biggest park, in which I got completely lost. And, you know, this was back in my carb-hungry days, and I like Ljubljana. My two abiding memories of Ljubljana are getting really, really lost in the park for hours whilst running and finding a bar called English Pub.
Great name.
Now, any bar called English Pub, you know it's going to be bad. But it was awesome. Because Slovenian beer is very tasty. What's the main beer that I had there? I think it was Laško, maybe. And it's absolutely beautiful. It's really light and it can get you really drunk, it turns out. So yeah. I go down to English Pub thinking, I've got to go in there for a beer. I've just got to see what it's all about. It's probably going to be some expat, two of his mates, just pissed up at the bar every day. And I walk in. I must have told you about English Pub.
No, first one.
Okay, so... I looked out my hotel window just like having a quick look around, and it was at the end of the street, and I was like, oh God, I'm going to have to do it. I'm going to have to find a kebab shop as well. So anyway, I walk into English Pub, and I was surprisingly the only customer, and the walls were festooned. It's the only word for it. Festooned with pictures of two people. Queen Elizabeth II, I mean, everywhere. Queen Elizabeth II and Sherlock Holmes.
Perfect.
It was just, I mean, every inch of every wall was Sherlock Holmes or Queen Elizabeth II. But it turns out it was a Slovenian guy's bar, and he was just a total Anglophile.
Okay.
Which is a bit pretty unusual, I would say. But he loved the football. And he was telling me that what he does is he's part of the England Supporters Club. And so when they play Slovenia, he goes in with the away fans. And I'm like, that's pretty brave. Because, you know, they are going to know you're Slovenian as soon as you speak. But they might not pick out Slovenia necessarily, but they're going to know you're Johnny Foreigner. And that often doesn't go down very well. I've seen some quite unpleasant incidents at football matches in the past. As a result of people being from different countries, it's the thing that's always pissed me off about football, that tribalism.
Mm.
Anyway, I digress slightly. So I ended up getting leathered in there with him. It's great.
Nice. That's good.
It's a great city, Ljubljana. If you ever do a city break, and I know like you live in one of Europe's great cities, but if you ever do a city break, Ljubljana's fabulous. Lovely cafe culture, great food, all the influences from around it. So you got like the influences of like Hungary and Italy and, you know, other places that border it. And it's just great food, lovely people, nice cafe culture, and a city that's about the size of Norwich, about 250,000 people in a country where it is 70% woodland, I think. And they've even got Alps.
Ooh,
got everything.
Go for a run. That's nice. Nice.
They've got everything. So other than something that happened to me probably 10 years ago and what happened this morning in the papers, what else is going on, Fintan? Have you got a clean car?
Not yet. The young gentleman's currently working on the car. <You're right>. he's a young lad. He cleans my car. I spilled coffee over the back of my car last weekend, and he's taking care of it. So
you've got a car boy.
No, he's a young gentleman, not a car boy. He's got a little kind of car call out home valeting system, and he'll just call out to your house and just sort it all out for you. So, but he was running late this morning, so I was running late.
Well, he's obviously very busy and in demand.
Yes, yeah, he is. He does a great job.
What's his business called? Do you know?
Oh, I can't remember. Auto car or something. I don't know. Oh, I can't remember.
It's going to be called Carboy, isn't it?
It's definitely not called that. It's something in Dutch. It's something about car cleaning in Dutch or something. What else? Stateside.
Oh, we recorded an episode of the podcast.
We did record an episode of the podcast.
We should probably talk about that.
We can talk about, absolutely. I was going to talk about Missouri's debating gambling legislation, but yeah, we can talk about that.
Oh, no, that's good too. Because hang on, it's not Missouri that's debating the, no, it's not, is it? Somewhere said yes, finally, to a tribal casino.
No, Missouri's, it's got derailed, but they were doing a sports betting bill in Missouri. I'm not sure.
A lot of bills. Bills are a long way from, you know, reality. Hang on, I'm going to get up my Substack because I'm way down with the kids. Massachusetts Tribal Casino, of course, because so when they started talking about the Massachusetts Tribal Casino, there were no casinos in Massachusetts.
Mm.
And now there's, I think, Encore Boston Harbor. And like, I think I saw something recently that said that was the most profitable casino in the US last year.
Really?
So that tribe is going to be thinking, fuck, bastards. You know, because they could have been way ahead of this curve. And now they're entering a market that has established competition, whereas it should have been the other way around. Boston Harbor should have been entering a market that already had a tribal casino. But it's complicated. You know, it must be immensely frustrating to be, you know, sort of claiming your right as a tribe, or trying to claim your right as a tribe, and just banging your head against the wall. And while you're banging your head against the wall, they've had 5 years to build, you know, a couple of properties, etc. And you're...
Because that's the thing, because there's such a long lead time on these properties, right? You can't, like, even if you get a green light today, like, how long before you're actually, people can walk in the door? It's huge.
We've got an agreement with Genting to build and operate the casino, which, obviously it's the most common way that casinos get established. And then often the tribe gets the experience and knowledge that it needs to ultimately take over the running of it itself or continue with the deal. And of course that brings in the investment to get it built. But they're talking about scaling back the original plans from a $1 billion casino in a market where there was no competition to something smaller. And I would be properly pissed off. But what do I know?
I agree.
So a lot of stuff going on in the world, it turns out.
And who do we have on the podcast today?
It's a great question, Fintan, and what I'm glad you asked. In a stellar week of two episodes, this second episode features none other than Mr. Paul Sculfer, our corporate overlord, redressing some of the terrible mistakes that I made last week when we were talking to Melanie Ellis about the sort of the how would I describe this? The nuances of the UK casino industry. So, the conversation isn't actually a UK centric one. We talk about the sort of profit thresholds for slots and how it's not as simple as, if I've got double the amount of slots, I'll get double the amount of revenue, because it doesn't work like that.
Do
you remember
fantastic.
What he talked about?
Yeah, we also talk about automation, and there was a lot. It's what's fascinating with Paul is he's such a casino expert, because he's been, you know, he's been doing this forever, and he gets used as a consultant to help loads. So he's got a super in-depth knowledge of the nuts and bolts of running a casino. That just kind of I walked away kind of going, I learned a lot there. All right, because I'm such an online nerd. The land-based stuff is to be honest a bit of a mystery to me. But Paul's he's an expert, and he gets into the details. He fact checks us basically, and
I think you could say he's a casino gardener, Because he knows his onions. Maybe we've got a new term for a specialist there.
I think that one's going to die right here and will never be used again.
I'm going to try and keep that alive. And just sometimes we've seen this from the current UK government and from previous controversial governments in history, where simple repetition of slogans and shit, essentially brainwashing and giving people things to repeat rather than having actual ideological arguments.
That's a good, effective. I'm going to build on that. I'm going to build on that because Gaming Recruitment Solutions, grs-recruit.com.
And it is a hyphen.
It is a hyphen for all your recruitment needs. If you're hiring for land-based or online, anywhere in the world, if you're looking for a new job, be it a dealer all the way up to C-level executives, or even compliance officers, as Paul talks about in the podcast, there's huge demand for compliance right now, and they're doing a lot of placements there. Talk to Paul and Gaming Recruitment Solutions.
I just had a thought, and this might appeal to you with your marketing head on.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if brainwashing has had a bad rap in terms of image. Maybe that's something we could work on here, because you're obviously trying to brainwash our listeners there. But maybe if we dress it up as brain valeting, it would be a bit more appealing.
Sure. Well, I wouldn't call it brainwashing. I'd call it, you know, influencing.
Yeah.
Yeah, presenting the facts and letting the user, the listener, make up their own minds. No, it's so we're going to brainwash people to think positively about brainwashing. Is that where we're going? Is that your
big idea? That's what I think we should do. In fact, if we take the brain part out, we can, mind valeting.
There's, you know, mate, there's probably a TED talk in that. There's like that feels like a TED talk speaker series podcast.
Yeah, and you give me all kinds of terrible ideas.
You get your car cleaned. Now time to clean your brain. Like there's a whole, yeah, needs a bit of work.
Fill it with new shit. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's marketable. And I think I think we could try it on the present UK government, because I think with brainwashing and stuff, I wonder if the relative intelligence of the receiver makes it more complicated, more difficult, and a longer process. And I think if we start with the current British government, current English government, we could just save ourselves a lot of time, because I think that'd probably just take a few minutes.
It's not an intelligence thing. So I can't remember the exact words, but I remember reading a book about hypnotism. It's basically the same thing, right? And it's not related to intelligence. Your receptibility or your ability to be hypnotized. So there was a couple of really interesting things. So one is a lot of people actually just fake it. So they're on stage and they feel like they should go along with it, and so that they do. Right? Because and this is like what a lot of like con tricks and stuff use as well. It preys on people's good nature to not offend, or to, you know, like if they're trying to steal your watch, they'll start shaking your hands and your instinct is to start shaking back, and then before you know it, they've taken the watch off your wrist with the other hand or whatever. Or like the phone scammer, like the guys who knock on your door and stuff, like they keep you talking, and the longer they keep you talking, the higher the chances you buy something, because you feel like the guys who stop you, the chuggers who stop you on the street, the whole thing is to keep you talking. So it's not an intelligence thing. It's more about willingness to be liked or to not offend. And I actually think politicians are so self-centered, they're actually fine. They're not actually as open to that. It's more about, what does this get me? So does this get me more money or more power? And that's what they're looking for.
It's interesting what you say about hypnotism, though, because that's going to make trips to the theatre for me considerably more comfortable. Because for many years, every time I've been to watch a hypnotist or any show with any degree of hypnotism in it, what I've done is I've put a hard-boiled egg up my ass just in case I get invited onto the stage, hypnotized into believing I'm a chicken.
And then pop one out.
Just in case it doesn't work, I'm like, I better have something prepared for this and something that's going to blow the audience's mind. I'm just going to drop my kecks and I'm going to lay an egg live on stage.
So you know what would be hilarious about that, right? So the audience would see that happen and obviously they'd be horrified, but they would just assume it was a setup by the magician. The magician would be standing there going, what the fuck has just happened? So you would actually reverse Uno the magician. I just picked this random guy and he's just shit out an egg. The fuck did that happen?
Hang on, I'm just gonna Google hypnotism shows local to me. Let's take them down.
Because the audience would be just like disgusted and like disappointed and it's so fake or whatever. And then the magician is just like, oh my God, I can't believe this has happened.
Oh my, I have more power than I realized.
Yeah, he's looking at his hands going, oh, it's real.
Shaking his head going, with great power comes great responsibility.
You know, he's calling Vegas. He's looking for his residency. Like, he's ready to go big time. I've cracked it.
I see what you did there. Cracked it. Anyway, Paul Skelfer of Gaming Recruitment Solutions is next.
Enjoy.
We welcome our first guest of the day, the appropriately titled corporate overlord, Mr. Paul Skelfer of Gaming Recruitment Solutions. Paul, hello.
Hello, guys. How are you doing?
I'm all right.
We're happy if you're happy, Paul. That's the key thing here.
Yeah, basically.
Yep, all good.
All right, cool. He's happy, John. He's happy.
Okay, thank you for joining us on today's episode. No, but, you know, thanks for joining us. But, well, Fenton, would you describe this as an era-defining episode, an epoch-marking episode, maybe?
Really? Sure.
I don't know.
Did I misread the script?
Aren't we towards the end of the GRS recruitment overlording?
That is true. That is true.
That is coming up towards the end. Fuck out of them next week.
No, we'd never do that. We'd never do that. Paul's been lovely. Absolutely.
Yeah,
lovely.
It's that Steve. Whew. Terrible problems with him. Yeah.
I don't know how many of them he listens to, but I think he listens to the ones that I'm on. So obviously be careful what you say. But
you mean he doesn't listen to everything we do? Oh, that's outrageous.
Well, yeah, it's lucky. Oh yeah, no, outrageous. That was the word I was looking for. So Paul emailed last week. We were talking to Mel. Paul was clarifying, because Paul, like, I know Paul for many years, you've acted as a consultant for a lot of license applications and stuff like that in the UK scene.
Yeah.
And you very kindly clarified some of the stuff about numbers and that we'd been talking about. And I stand by, I think, one thing I said, which is I think there's only about 4 casinos in the UK that could actually physically accommodate the maximum number of slots anyway.
If you're working on the 150 from a large license, yeah, there's that's probably about right.
But then there's kind of the, when you say the large license, right, this is the large license under the 2005 Act, And how many casinos in the UK come under that description of a large license?
Well, there are 8 areas that are allowed to have a large license, but there are only 4 that are actually in operation. So you've got Resorts World in Birmingham, or strictly speaking in Solihull. You've got Aspers in Stratford, Victoria Gate Casino in Leeds, and Aspers in Milton Keynes, or Aspers MK. And the other 4 were never, or have not so far been developed. A couple have been awarded, but they haven't gone anywhere. So yeah, just 4.
And 2 of those are Aspers. I would have thought, in terms of square footage, I would have thought Aspers Northampton must be... Hang on, that is still open, isn't it?
Yes, it's physically big enough, but it wasn't one of the areas where the Casino Advisory Panel decided a large licence could be awarded. And it starts getting quite a long story, but the process by which they decided who could have one was all regenerative. So
places Are you telling me Northampton couldn't do some regeneration?
Well, it was perceived. I mean, compared to Stratford, you could argue that Stratford's got a better case, but you ended up with ones in places like Southampton, which already had 3 operating casinos. So consequently, the process never went anywhere. And it was a whole bunch of time wasted. And a couple of the so-called small licences were just ludicrous. One was in Dumfries and Galloway, which is somewhere in Scotland. I couldn't point to on a map. But you're never going to build one there.
The bottom left of Scotland, bordering England. And where The Wicker Man was quite famously filmed.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
It's somewhere like Dumfries and Galloway. I mean, not a lot of big sort of what you would call population centres there.
No.
And it's quite a sparsely populated sort of county. It'd be like just putting one in Shropshire.
Pretty well, worse probably, in the basis that the biggest town, Stranraer, which I've only ever heard of because he's got a football team. But, I mean, they made these decisions with, it would seem, no thought whatsoever as to whether they were ever going to get built. It was more of a who needs help, or who could theoretically do with a boost to the economy, and without any regard to the fact that no operator is going to go near it. One of the other small ones was in East Lindsay, which is where I grew up, in Lincolnshire. And the biggest town there is Skegness. Who's going to build a casino in Skegness with a minimum floor area? It's just, that's madness.
Was Great Yarmouth one of the...
It was, yeah. It was a large, but because they're...
They had, I think they had at the time, didn't they have 3?
Yeah, 3 at the time. Now 2. And it was the way the process works is, because I was involved in quite a lot of them, including Great Yarmouth, on the council side as their kind of casino specialist. And in Great Yarmouth, the bid that won, or all anyone who won one of these competition processes, the license is pinned to an individual site, an individual location, and can't be moved. And the one in Great Yarmouth was in a like a prospective new theme park, or leisure park rather, and it just wasn't economically viable. So the people who owned the park got the license, offered it to all the operators, and all the operators basically said, "There's not enough people here to justify what'll end up being a 30,000 square foot casino." Just it couldn't work.
I mean, obviously Norwich is only just down the road, and Yarmouth is still a bit of a. I mean, it's still a reasonable destination.
Yeah,
but Norwich is only 250,000 people.
That'd be fine. I mean, from a cap point of view, if they'd offered it in Norwich, where there's no competition other than Great Yarmouth, that somebody would have taken it up and run with it and made some money. But in the end, it was a great long process of deciding which areas got casinos, and half of them haven't been taken up entirely predictably. Just a huge waste of time and a wasted opportunity.
Yeah, I did wonder at the time about the sort of the size definitions. And it did seem awfully, well, I was going to say ambitious, misguided. That's another good word. Oh, somebody at the door. Finn, carry on, would you?
So, Paul, last week your email, I made one of my classic kind of sweeping statements of, I think the land-based casinos are going to win in the Gambling Act review,
right?
In terms of more slots, it's a better time to be a land-based casino, more parity with online. And you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think there seems to be, if you look at kind of annual reports for the major operators over the last few years and what they think is going to happen if they're offered more slots, I mean, it does seem there's a general consensus that they are expecting more slots, more B1 slots in every casino license. So as it stands, the 05 Act licenses have more than 20. All the 1968 Gaming Act licenses only have 20, and every operator thinks they'll make a ton more money if they get more slots. Now, I'm sure they will make more money, but the perception seems to be that if they get 40 slots, they'll make double the money in a lot of sites, and it's just not going to be that way. Now, the way, in my view, you do this analysis is if you've got 20 slots right now making $1.5 million a year, which is about what the UK average is, you know, you don't look at the average win per slot of whatever that works out to be, 75 grand. You look at your 20th slot, you look at your worst performing slot and think of adding more at that kind of number, because it isn't as simple as, you know, if you don't have the demand, you're not going to make the money. You know, if you all of a sudden put 100 slots in a Lincolnshire field, you aren't going to make any money. So just because they're going into a licensed casino doesn't mean to say that it's not a case of if you build it, they will come. If you're not making a lot of money right now in a UK casino, just because you've got more slots, that isn't going to make a huge difference. I think overseas, they've used win per machine per day as a metric for years. I think that there's a real danger in doing that. It works in some jurisdictions where there's no competition. But in the UK, you know, if you want to play slots here in the UK, from where you're sitting right now, John or I, you know, there's pubs around the corner with AWPs, there's betting shops, there's arcades, there's bingo clubs, and there's casinos. So it's not as straightforward as more slots equals a lot more money. And I think there's a danger that the offline casino world has set so much store in more slots rescuing the industry that I think if it does go to, let's say, 60 per site, then I'm not entirely convinced that it's going to be a rescuer, bearing in mind that the offline sector's in a fair amount of trouble already.
I'm back, by the way.
So I hadn't thought of the, obviously I hadn't because I'm an idiot, but the, you know, look at the performance of your worst, look at like how your worst performing slot does and add more to that. Or like kind of assume like, I think that's a really neat way to extrapolate the future.
I mean, the theory of that one is your 20th best slot, if there's a way to make it perform better, you would do that. You would put it in a better location, or if you had a world of multiple manufacturers, and there aren't, there's only really three now, then you'd do that. Every casino should be doing everything they can to make their worst slot perform better, and therefore if you add another slot, it shouldn't be able to do better than your 20th. You know, the 21st should be a slightly lower take. There are very limited times in the UK in most casinos, you know, on a busy Saturday night when you're close to capacity, you know, that's when an extra slot will help you. But, you know, you go into almost any site in the UK outside London, certainly on a Thursday night at midnight, and there'll be five or six slots being played. So how does another slot help you? I just don't see how it does.
That's true.
And we pay a fortune for them in the UK as well, because it's such a small market, and the math pay table has to be fitted to the UK stakes and prizes limits. Then there's two major suppliers, a third one who Blueprint, who are getting involved, and I should declare I'm helping them out a little bit with introductions. With only three manufacturers, that doesn't give you an awful lot of options as an operator either. And I did a big old casino tour last week. I did, I think, 11 in 4 days. Just to get back into the business, and I hadn't spent enough time on the floors kind of thing. And it is really depressing when you've only got two, or in some cases three, different manufacturers to play on. You know, if you're in Vegas, I'll change every 20 minutes because I get bored and want to play something else. In the UK, you can't. You know,
Who are they?
Novomatic are market leader. IGT have traditionally been the other one. You know, at times they've been ahead, I think, slightly, but in terms of number of boxes, it's Novomatic right now. And then Blueprint are the only other people who are supplying B1 slots right now. Others have been in the market. Aristocrat were around for a while, Scientific Games as well, but at the moment there's only really three.
I do remember, it might be the classification that's the thing here. I do remember it was in the Hippodrome. They had a machine by, I think it was an R. Franco machine. Do you remember the one with the roulette device attached to the top?
Yeah.
I mean, that was wicked. It just looked brilliant on the floor.
They are. They were great. I mean, they were officially electronic roulette, so they weren't B1 slots.
Okay.
There's a bunch of people who supply electronic roulette products. I mean, it's a cornerstone of the UK industry now. I'll go so far as to say, without electronic roulette, most casinos in the UK wouldn't continue trading. because obviously staff are expensive. They're almost impossible to get hold of. So if you can offer roulette without having to have a licensed dealer attached to it, then that's where you can make money at minimal cost. I think I was at a Facebook argument with someone a little while ago saying that electronic roulette was you know, it was an outrage. It's taken away the essence of casinos, but without it, you'd be torpedoed. It's absolutely a critical kind of underlay element of the income.
I think if you look at how some of the companies are approaching electronic roulette, how they're approaching electronic table games, and it's some of them, I'm thinking very specifically actually of Interblock and the Stadium concept. Yeah. And they've actually reintroduced or they have introduced the social aspect of gaming to the solitude of terminal gaming, I suppose. So Fintan, in case you are not aware of this, Stadium concept is like, it's almost like, imagine your dealer as a DJ.
Okay.
And you've got like this Stadium setup of it's sort of coming out like a Trivial Pursuit cheese from the dealer. And it's, you know, it depends on your location. It depends on your customers, but it can be done like a club setup. Or it can be done, you know, if you've got an older customer, it's the middle of the day in the middle of the week, you know, you just change the sort of tone of it. I think Foxwoods have got 3 stadium setups. And like Foxwoods, in case you're not aware of this, Fintan, historically, I don't know if it still is, but it was the most profitable casino in the US. It's on the Connecticut-New York State border. And it's a massive, great development. So 3 stadiums in Foxwoods, or 3 stadia in Foxwoods, that's a testament to how effective they can be.
Your description wasn't about. I've got a picture. I've just Googled it.
That's a phenomenal description.
So for the listeners, imagine that there's 2 dealers standing at a table, at 2 tables, facing an audience. And then there's like rows of chairs facing the dealers, where each chair has got a touch screen where they can place their bets and do everything that they need to do. That's really interesting, because that's also a really good setup for a live dealer as well. So like for an online live dealer setup as well. So
you
get
you could run an online from that, definitely. In fact, some places do.
Which would be a great kind of doubling up of, well, play online at your favorite casino with your favorite dealers. It's the same setup as though you're there. And so you expand that kind of wallet opportunity.
And in theory, I think you can put up to 999 terminals on a single dealer.
Wow.
I think Holland Casinos do quite a bit of this. I forget whether they brand it, I think something like Next or Go or something similar. And I think what seems to be the consensus is what you get is, obviously, you're not going to get traditional players as much, people who like to sit there for a long time and play relatively heavily. It's designed to be an entry-level product. You know, you're trading off the atmosphere. Mm. I think from reading something, I think it was Holland Casinos, they did intimate that the take wasn't huge, but the idea was that it, you know, it gets people into the casino for the first time. That's relatively easy, but it gets them playing for the first time. You know, it's designed to go in with your friends and make it a social experience. You know, you're not trying to hook people on gambling, you're trying to get people to substitute a cinema night or a restaurant night with a casino night instead. That makes sense
because looking at the pictures, you would imagine it'd be less intimidating to sit down at one of these terminals than to sit down at a blackjack table.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah. Totally. And you know, without a member of staff, you can train somebody on a game.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the easiest way to learn any game is with your mates messing around with a drink and you know taking it, and you can't make a mistake, you can't embarrass yourself. It's the same reason why electronic roulette's been so key to the UK is this has taken it a stage further. And one of the problems you've got in the UK is to have an electronic table game, you can't do it on an RNG basis. This is something that was being talked about as being part of the white paper. So if you're going to run a roulette game on a terminal, there has to be a physical ball dropping into a physical wheel somewhere. That's fine, because that's happening all over casinos. But to run a blackjack game, there have to be physical cards being pulled. That's when it starts to run into problems, because obviously some people want to take a card on a given total, some people don't. So a blackjack game in the UK on terminal, I was, again, playing them, I shan't say with which company, but just a rubbish experience. It just, you know, it didn't work at all. if that changes, then there's going to be a whole bunch of electronic table games manufacturers charging over to the UK, ready to sell them virtual blackjack and virtual everything else. But last I heard, the rumor was it wasn't going to be permitted within the white paper.
You can't play simultaneous games in the UK, can you?
That's right. You can't switch tables, so you get balls dropping, you know, every few seconds. The combination of electronic with online seems to work pretty well as well, exactly as you were saying. You know, when you see a table, if you don't have to censor the faces, that there's obviously people having a good time playing if you're online, and it's dealers that you might know from the casino. That seems like it would work that pretty well. But I think I'm right in saying in the online world, you know, you've got people supplying feeds from casinos all over the world, which you've never been to. So it's not necessarily the personal thing. It's just the feeling of other people having fun that you can join in with. Maybe it's the same as the kind of comedy concept we were talking about earlier on. If you feel part of it, it's more enjoyable.
You feel part of it, I think there's also, there can be a mistrust of, you know, virtual blackjack versus, or roulette versus a real wheel. That's why live makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that, because I was just thinking about this. I remember seeing a couple of wheels demoed, a couple of roulette wheels demoed. And they were demoed with completely opposite USPs, right? Okay. And I to this day I still don't get it. I understood one of them, the other one I didn't really understand. So one of them was saying, so at the end of the spin, in the wheel sensor tells you which numbers come up, and the wheel drops a bit, and the ball comes out, and you know. And then it's reintroduced for another spin. And the players like that because, you know, you can't do anything to the ball. It's constant. Something's constantly happening to it. I might be paraphrasing a little bit and I might be remembering it wrong. But the other wheel, I do remember this very clearly, and the other wheel was a Cami wheel. And they developed an automated wheel where the ball is visible 100% of the time. And it uses little jets of compressed air to bring the ball back into play for a spin, out of the pocket, little, and then the wheels go, another blast when it hits the top to spin, and different pressures each time as well, so the spin is actually variable. And it was fantastic. I can totally see that working. That's the kind of thing where I'd be like, yeah, well, this is clearly not fixed.
Those are the slingshot wheels that you were talking about there. I think the fact the ball's visible the whole time. But Cami, they've got some great stuff. They were talking me through last time I was at their place, the variable rotor speed. Because I think when you get, if you work in an online casino with a wheel, you know, in a live casino, you can't sit there tracking the wheel with an electronic device for hours because someone's going to ask what you're doing. Whereas online, you can obviously, with video streaming of the wheel 100% of the time, if there is a weakness or a bias in the wheel, or any element of predictability, people are going to spend weeks of solid time analysing it. And one of the products they have is this variable rotor speed. So if the dealer spins the ball and then, or dealer spins the cone in the inside of the wheel and then spins the ball the opposite direction, there's a motor in the wheel that takes over and changes the speed of the part of the wheel that rotates just to make it almost impossible to track it. And I think, you know, it's a constant cat and mouse fight between advantage players and operators, but that's one way of killing off one opportunity for the cheats.
That's interesting.
Speaking of Cami, I think they've got some lovely roulette side bets as well. I think they've got some very, very valuable intellectual property there. I think they're going to do really well off that.
I didn't see it at the show, and I annoyed myself because I heard about it afterwards, but that is the dream is to find a roulette side bet that people love, because blackjack, it's been cracked, you know, starting with perfect pairs, and you know, anything with a real simple principle. If your two cards are the same, you get paid out. If they're the same in the same suit, you get paid out 35-1 or whatever it might be. No one's ever really cracked it on roulette. Having something that has a big enough payoff and yet is easy enough to understand is the challenge. And if they've got close to that, then they'll make a lot of money.
I was talking for quite a while with a game inventor of my acquaintance, as something of a legendary gentleman, because I think that you could monetize the end game of the game Shithead. And also, I would say that it markets itself.
Well, yes. I'm not familiar. Do tell.
What? You don't know shit, Fintan? You must know shithead.
I've heard of it. I'm pretty sure I've played it drunk in college, but I couldn't. What? Put a gun to my head. I couldn't give you the rules right now.
Right, so let me see if I've got a deck of cards here. Oh, man, wouldn't you know it? No suppositories, no. Heat packs, portable batteries. Sugar tongs. I've got sugar tongs.
Nice.
Thank God.
I mean, of all the things, I don't want to be caught without those. So the end game, after you've gotten rid of all your cards, is you have, let me see if I'm with the sugar, you've got three face down cards dealt in front of you, and you have three face up cards on top of those, right? And you can play these cards in any order, but you have to play the three face up cards, then the three face down cards. Okay?
Okay.
If you can't beat the card that's been put down, and I won't go into the rules of the rest of the game, but if you can't, then you have to pick up the cards that are in play, all of them.
Okay.
And obviously when you're playing your face down cards, you're playing them blind. You're not going to look at them and go, no, I don't want to play that. You pick a card and you play it. And all I just couldn't think of where you introduce the house edge. So if you two could have a think about that. Such a good game.
I thought you were going to do a big reveal. I thought you'd figured it out.
Well, no, I couldn't figure out the house edge. I mean, that's why I took it to this genius of a man, a titan amongst game inventors. Not Jeff, in case anybody's listening and thinking, oh, he's been talking to Jeff. I wasn't Jeff. But I think whoever is left with the cards at the end of the game, everybody else points at them and goes, shithead.
Well, yeah.
Which is where the game gets its name.
Interesting.
I mean, I used to deal with product development for Rank years and years ago, and I still get sent a lot of new games. I haven't actually had the shithead pitch yet, but I'm sure it's imminent. But I still get new games sent my direction quite a bit, and it's unbelievable how bad most of them are. You've got to reflect back on the idea that in a casino on a Saturday night, you've got about a 60-second window before a player says, nah, too complicated. And you know, people, like, I guess, like us, who've been in the industry a while, it should be intelligible quicker than that. So essentially, if I look at a game and I don't understand the main bet within 20 seconds, I take the view that it's too complicated. And that every game that's been remotely successful recently works with that. So you look at something like three-card poker. In the pair plus bet on three-card poker, I can explain it to you in 20 seconds and everybody would understand it. But the level of complexity that you see in, well, new games that are launched by individuals, never by people like, well, all the different people who offer games, Galaxy Gaming and so on, their games are reasonably sensible, but the kind of single game inventors will come up with their genius concoction that's more complicated than Monopoly, and it's just laughably impossible to imagine them on a gaming floor. They just don't, the kind of inventors, it becomes their baby and it becomes something that they, you know, often invest a lot of their money in, but they don't recognise the fact that it doesn't, if it makes as much money as a roulette table, for example, that's not interesting, because why would you not just stick with the roulette table? It's got to make a lot more. And there's been almost nothing in the last 20 years, I would say, that's really had an impact other than three-card poker. And it's anyone who ever kind of talks about inventing a new game, I always kind of just say, don't bother. It's just too tough.
There was a really good podcast I listened to about a month or so ago. It was a guy called Tim Ferriss, who's like a massive podcast thing. But he had a guy on called Elan Lee, who was the inventor of exploding kittens,
right.
Which is I don't know if you've played it with your kids yet, but it's this, like, it was the most backed card game on Kickstarter and all this kind of stuff. But they've gone on to become like a game studio, and they produce all these different types of card games now. But his whole process for like game design and inventing games, so much of it's just what you're saying of like, how quickly can I understand it? How quickly can I get playing? And then just tons and tons and tons of user testing.
Yep.
And they just do massive amounts of rounds of user testing and then just try and simplify. So you're kind of cutting as much away from the game without losing the core mechanic of what makes an interesting game. And he had these whole concepts around like the tension and share. Like it was super fascinating.
And I always look at it in terms in casino games is if it, you know, test one, is it simple enough to understand quickly? If it passes that, then ideally you're looking for more than one reveal. So, you know, or a moment of excitement. So in blackjack, you get your first card, then you see the dealer's card. They're both two separate events that are important. Then you get your second card. Then obviously if you're taking cards from there, and then when the dealer completes their hand, they're all separate individual moments of excitement. Roulette, generally there's only one, but it's a big build-up, obviously, when the ball drops. Ideally, you want to use an example at the other end, Casino War, if you've ever played that. It couldn't be simpler.
I've had that in the back of my head, this whole conversation.
One card each. If yours is high, you win. If yours is low, you lose. The house edge comes if you get the same card. Yeah, that's a great game to get people to play for the first time. But if they're still interested after 15 minutes, they've got us. They're easier to please than I am because you need some depth. But as long as you can understand some part of it straight away and then go on to get a bit deeper, I think that's when you've got something that's worth having. But it is so difficult now. And the number of times I've been approached with a game, and it makes you want to cry because it starts off, I've got this new game. And you go, oh, Christ. And then it goes, well, it's a mix of, and you go, oh, don't say blackjack and craps or punter, banco and roulette. And it always is. It's just not a growth area. There are better ways to make money, I think.
Fair.
Well, we're gonna figure out the house edge for shithead and become squillionaires.
Seems that way. It's only got a catchy name.
I wouldn't have brought it up if I didn't think it had great potential. I think the Kemi side bets on Roulette, I think they're solid. What do I know? The thing is, right, Fintan, if you get to the stage where you can actually get a game on trial in a casino, Jesus, it had better be good. Because you've got to train the dealer to understand it in order to sell it to the players. And the dealer will be able to tell you straight away, get fucked or okay. And you've basically got a couple of weeks. And it better start making some serious money in that time. Yeah. Because you've replaced something that is established and was already at least doing an expected average. You know, you maybe replaced a standard blackjack table.
Sure.
So you've got to, you know, there's a lot of pressure.
Here's my pitch, right? We're gonna mix it up a little bit. I'm going to take Jake Paul. Yeah?
Yeah.
It's going to be Prime Blackjack. Yeah, are you guys familiar with the Prime drink from Jake Paul?
I'm
aware of its existence.
Yeah, so a massive sellout, people fighting over it, paying. So we get the celebrity endorsement game. All right, and we do it that way.
Okay.
Throw it out there. Shoot it down.
Well, how many people have bought the Prime drink that are over 18? There are probably people stupid enough.
Details.
This is why Paul gets paid the big bucks. That's why he's a corporate overlord, not a fucking underling.
Not a co-host.
Exactly.
But that's actually a very good point. So obviously Jake Paul's got his whole better thing in America, which is like that micro betting thing.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who we had on. We were talking to somebody about it. And I was kind of given the breakdown. It's like, it was like what you've just done with the game of like, but like from an online marketing perspective, okay, he's got a squillion followers on social media. How many are in America? How many are actually in Ohio? How many are over 21 that want to bet on NFL? And you take a very big number and all of a sudden you get it down to a very small number. And then you're ended up with like, now what? Like, and how does that compare to a FanDuel or a DraftKings or whatever? So I do think you're right that there is. Yeah, I'd say yeah, you're right, Johnny. Smart.
In those situations, if you're bringing a Jake Paul on board, you want him in on rev share, but they know better. They're not stupid enough to let that happen. There is somehow the kind of celebrity connection side of things has to be able to pay off better than it does at the moment. I'm old enough to despise social media in pretty much all its forms, but I understand the power of it, or I recognise the power of it. I don't understand any part of it, but there has to be a more effective way of making that work. I mean, the kind of ambassadors for football clubs that tie in with the shirt sponsorship, it's as you said, the ones that seem to work well are when it's in a overseas market, but in the Premier League, you know, the kind of sports books that are open to the Middle East or Far East. But someone sooner or later is going to make that really work, because the power is too strong not to. But as you say, the deals with people who've got a huge social media presence, a tiny proportion of which are potential customers, aren't it? So there you go. There's a big list of things that don't work. If I got paid the really big bucks, I'll be telling you stuff that will work rather than stuff that won't. But there you go.
Well, you save that for the paying clients, right? That's
exactly.
The magic.
Yeah, and give this that away for free to the likes of that us. Back.
He's giving away the negative stuff. Imagine what he's keeping. But no, but you're right, though. If you look at steak, for example, that's a really interesting one right now in terms of...
Had one earlier.
The other steak. So it's a crypto betting casino platform out of Australia. Surprisingly,
yeah, that's what I had.
That's your thing, is it? And the lads are completely open to like media. So there was a big write up in the FT last week, or this week. There was a big write up in the FT about them, and there was like one of the quotes from like a former staff member talking about really casual. Oh, like this Singapore VIP player was put down $1 million on a hand or something. And you're like, well, that's massively illegal. Like, is nobody going to ask them about that? Or, but then what they've also done is they've bought Kick. So Kick is like a video streaming. It's a bit like basically Twitch was clamping down on gambling and particular crypto brands. So the guy said, screw this. We're going to get our own Twitch with blackjack and hookers, and launched Kick. And Kick is literally full of blackjack and hookers is the best way to describe it. It's like an unmoderated Twitch, which is like just a cesspit of get-rich-quick scams and semi-porn and incels and all this kind of thing.
It's basically an imbecile magnet. Lovely.
Yeah, pretty much, pretty much. But then when the FT did the revenue stuff, like these guys are as big as, like, I think they're like a top six global gambling brand.
What was that URL?
Stake.com. STAKE.
Got it. Thanks. Incels and what?
Blackjack and hookers.
Great. I'm on. Did I ever tell you my possibly completely misguided theory about the place of social media in society?
I've heard bits of it. You're referring to it in parallel with religion, weren't you, I think?
Yeah, totally. And the more that I think about it and the more that I see it sort of exercised, I no pun intended, I do stand by it. I think it's the way that people fill that colossal sort of metaphysical gap.
Oh, I get that.
There's another theory.
Oh yeah.
So there is. So the other theory is, and it's, I'm not smart and it's not mine, is because the internet was built up upon advertising revenue. So the internet revenue model is selling advertising. Therefore, the more time on site, the more impressions, more things like this, the more advertising money you make and the bigger your business is. So if you take social media, the whole point of social media then is to keep you on social media because they sell more advertising, they make more money. And then the algorithms then have been trained to optimize for that, which is then where you get the outrage and the strong reactions on either side, regardless of which team you're on or who you support, whatever. And the whole thing is around that. And then the really interesting kind of follow-up to that is, and that's why like TikTok is like crack. It's unbelievable. I've never tried crack, but it's very addictive.
Moorish.
I felt like it was just like, I felt really dirty old man. It was very, very bad. You probably reach a point, in your life where you walk into a nightclub and you go, oh, I shouldn't be here. This isn't for me.
About 20 years ago, I remember that. Right. Yeah.
This isn't for me. I used to be young, and with TikTok, it really was like one of the first things on the internet where I'm like, this isn't for me. Like, I'm not. I shouldn't be here. I need to leave. I'm ruining everyone's time. Like, who's the old geezer in the corner? That's a bit weird, right? But the really interesting one then is if you look at the chat stuff like ChatGPT and Google Bard and all these tools that are coming out. If they're built, so what ChatGPT is right now, so it's like a subscription model. That's actually really good for society if it stays a subscription model and they don't switch to an ad model.
Right. Yeah.
Because the chatbot will just keep you going. And like, there's literally, like this week there was a report, like some guy's committed suicide because he got really deep into a chatbot that basically convinced himself that, or convinced them that, to help the climate change, the best thing he could do was die. And then there's one brand, and it's it gives you a virtual girlfriend. All right, so the chatbot's this virtual girlfriend. It's never a boyfriend, it's always a girlfriend. It's just blokes are just simple creatures. And girls are too smart for that. And the Italian government clamped down on it because of, like, basically it was like all your sexual fantasies and all this kind of stuff all through chat. And the Italian government clamped down on it, and the publisher, the owner of it, whatever, made some fundamental change. The changes were so dramatic for the community of people who were using this app. The one of the forums they all hang out on had to publish like suicide helplines. And it was just like all these messages about like, I've lost my girlfriend and I can't believe you've done this to me, and just completely sucked into it. And it's obviously sad, and there's obviously clearly underlying other issues and stuff there. But if you think of like, this is like the really early days of these AI things. This is like, this isn't even like the Nokia phone. This is like the massive car phone with the battery radio thing in the boot and the massive hands. Like, we're such early days of this. It's going to get bonkers.
Yeah, that is scary.
What could possibly go wrong?
It's going to be insane.
But on the plus side, I think what you will see as a longer term result of this is, I think you will see, this might, I don't know whether this will seem like a stretch, but yeah, you see the value for some of these things. You can see how there will be benefits to the way that these things could work in healthcare, for example, things like that.
Yeah.
But in terms of your day to day, say you're using a dating website, something like that, right? Like, what's the term for somebody using a fake thing? Is it
catfish?
Right. So, say the potential for catfishing is just, I mean, mind blowing suddenly.
Yeah.
So, what you might find is that people will go back to the old ways of doing things, where you actually talk to other people in person, where you can read body language, and where a simple kick to the groin will tell you if they're real or not.
Well, yeah.
And as a result of that, people may actually turn kind of inwards in the grander sense and become more community minded. And, you know, I'm out quite lucky where I live. I'm in Wales, so there's no choice other than to be community minded.
Yeah. but it's, so it, that to me is a bit like the, you know, the million, the unlimited monkeys that an unlimited typewriter is going to create Shakespeare.
Sorry. Right. Great Simpsons joke when Monty Burns is trying that, and it was the best of times. It was the blurst of times.
That's not the worst impression I've heard either. Jeez.
It's a good one. But so, and I think you're right. I think ultimately they're going to get there. But with the monkey analogy, they're going to make monkey porn before they get to Shakespeare. And so you're going to have the worst of people as well before you get to the backlash. And I think that's going to happen first. So I think it's actually going to be really bad in a lot of ways.
I think for me, the outcome that we're talking about is influenced by social media as well. So it's all one and the same thing. I think fundamentally what the problem is, what social media has told people is that life is interesting and good, whereas most of life is boring and tedious, interspersed with ideally lots of good days and some really shit days. And, you know, particularly Instagram, I don't touch Instagram, but they're trying to convince you that life is really, really good, and it isn't. You know, I'm not saying that I'd have a great life or a shit life, but most days aren't particularly exciting. So if someone's telling you that everyone else is having great days all the time, you're going to feel like you don't measure up, and it's just not true. It's kind of fundamental.
That's a very good way of looking at it.
Something my wife said, actually, we were talking about, I forget what TV show we were watching, and it was set in the 50s when everything was grey and dull and boring, and it was like overstating the fact that there was nothing to do, no one had any money. And she made the point that if you'd lived through the Second World War you know, worried that you're going to be in Britain, you know, invaded and conquered by the Germans, and that your husband's going to get sent away to die. The idea of having a decade of, with nothing to do and just sit in the sun and, you know, no TV, no mod cons, that'd be brilliant. And because their expectations were so low, don't get invaded. If you tick that box, then you're happy. And it, I think it's just, it's expectations versus reality. And we've gone far too far towards thinking that everything should be perfect, and it's not.
I like that.
There you
go.
Life philosophy in 30 seconds.
I'm stealing that. That's great.
I've always said, Fintan, you set the bar low and you are probably not going to be disappointed.
Yeah, but that's not how my brain works, mate. That's my problem.
There's two ways or one way to live a happy life, which is to reach your expectations. There's two ways to get there: achieve more or expect less. And I, you know, there's a mix of the two.
Yeah, of all of my school friends, I think only one of them, you know, maybe two, but only one of them had a really concrete idea of what they wanted to do, and they you know, they nailed that by their mid-20s. And I just thought, well, what are you going to do now? I mean, don't get me wrong, they seem pretty content. The other one is, of course, Toby, who wants to be an actor.
Of course, it's Toby.
And is. I told you Toby's greatest role, didn't I? I must have.
No.
When he played a he's totally tone deaf, Toby, and he got a part in an opera where he played a mute.
Versatility.
I like it.
But it's a true story. I was like, that's fantastic, because he's good at doing the sort of, you know, almost 1910s style of acting where you do the completely overblown facial expressions in the silent era. He's really, really good at that. And so I bet that he would have been pretty decent.
That's hilarious. I love it. Versatile, that, Toby. Versatile.
We should get him on. I know we talked about it earlier, but the more I think about it, the more I think, I mean, I don't know how we're going to get him.
I'm a bit worried now, because you've hyped him up so much.
Yeah.
That's the thing, though. Like,
should I meet my heroes?
I've known Toby for like, what, about 35 years, something like that. And
we could just have him come on and tell John stories. It'd be perfect.
That would be good. Ideally, when John's away, so he can tell the really evil ones.
There we go.
I don't think he'll know. There can't be that many, because in all the bad ones, he was doing the same stupid shit as I was. So I'm reasonably safe. Reasonably. Paul, today you were featured. I say today, that's yesterday for listeners, tomorrow. Paul, you were on the new and more Empire publication today. So tell us a bit about that. So first of all, what is it? We've got Overlords plugging Overlords. Whoa.
There you go. Meta. The publication, it was I forget exactly what they called it. It was kind of careers focused with a compliance angle. So they just asked me to add a few bits about the state of the market, which in compliance it's interesting. A few years ago, it was a clear situation where there just weren't enough experienced compliance people. The market went a bit nuts. We were asked to fill a couple of chief compliance officer roles, and one of them we couldn't find anyone. You know, we don't like failing, but on that one we did. It was just a case where there wasn't a pipeline of people coming through, because the law and interpretation of the law had changed faster than the market did. It's started to equalize now. You certainly see people we've placed in relatively junior roles getting paid a lot more than they might do in an equivalent level role in another sector. So yeah, it's an interesting situation. I think there's, for people who want to go all the way in compliance, there's obviously, they can transfer. There's a lot of transferable skills and knowledge into the finance world as well. You know, as gambling gets more and more wrapped up in anti-money laundering regulations, then a lot of that is, in some cases, it's the same law and the same practices. So it's if you can stand the fact that it's, the cliche would be to say it's a bit negative as a calling. It's a good spot to be in. There's all sorts of opportunities, and it's getting better all the time, I think.
And what kind of background, like, if you were looking, if, because obviously there's probably more roles than there is people in the pipeline, like through natural progression within the company stuff. So you're then probably looking at a lot of switchers or mid-career change and stuff like that. What is it? Is it a legal background, or is there people coming in from other areas?
I think it depends on what level. If you're entry level or second job level, then it's it's a lot broader than that. If you've got some of it's just handling data, which doesn't have to be at the kind of huge data level. It's just the ability to handle a few different data sources at once. And funny enough, actually, in the same piece that we were talking about, I quoted I use LinkedIn a lot. I have to working in recruitment, and the number of meaningless imbecile memes you get on there is extraordinary. But I did see one the other day which really does ring true, which was the best ability in a working environment, the best ability you can have is to be easy to work with. And I thought that was massively relevant, and it's true. The I'm sure in all our working lives you'd always rather work with someone who's not the best possible deliverer of results, but is easy to get along with and someone you can actually have a conversation with. And I think in compliance at the junior levels, it's just the ability to handle a bit of data, obviously the ability to be diligent, because it's, you know, the penalties for getting it wrong are pretty severe. But I don't think there's any particular pattern that you, or particular profile that you need to have to get into those roles. Once you get further up or more senior, then I think once you get to the very senior level, it's every operator, they want their compliance person to have a blend of yeah, protecting the business, but at the same time being commercial. And I could be the most effective compliance officer in the world by saying, right, no customers. Customers cause all the problems. If not any of those, we won't break the law. But it's finding the sweet spot between keeping the company safe, but not shutting off revenue avenues. And you see that. I mean, in casinos, you could list all the operators pretty much on that spectrum from super super safe. In some cases, because they've been fined millions of pounds and learned the lesson, to right in the sweet spot of commercially aggressive but still protecting themselves, to the other end where there's one or two operators who you would say are playing fast and loose a little bit and may well get their fingers burnt. So the ideal senior compliance person gets you right in the middle of that, takes as many opportunities as they can without exposing the business. And ideally, obviously, you want to be an ethical operator as well, but that there are plenty of areas of the law where it's a matter of interpretation rather than a matter of ethics. And I think you just want people who get that.
Yeah, I've definitely seen situations where they've had a bad experience and fine or whatever, and then it feels like the compliance department is now running the company, and all logic has gone out the window.
Absolutely,
this is like way above and beyond anything reasonable. I've definitely seen that.
It was really interesting listening to Melanie last week talk about with the William Hill fine having just come out kind of that day. I think that it's easy to think of this as, well, William Hill made a mess of this, they got it wrong. Overall, of course, they did. But the truth is, it's dozens, if not hundreds, of individuals working on their own little part of it with communication challenges and interdepartmental rivalry stroke head to heads. These are super complicated situations. And it's never, you know, you couldn't come back and then say, well, William Hill, they're a bad company, because that's just not the case. They're a combination of factors from scale, communication difficulties, to some extent, taken risks they shouldn't have taken, I would imagine, but it's way more complicated than, you know, William Hill bad, you know, company B who haven't got fined are good.
I agree, because like one of the examples that made the BBC headlines was a player had done something within 20 minutes.
Yeah, 23 grand, wasn't it, the buy-in? I remember seeing that.
Yeah, like within 20 minutes, and you're like, oh, that's a lot of money in a very short period of time. But then you think about the logistics behind the scenes to be able to react within 20 minutes. Because it didn't say like at what time of day or night it happened at, or could have been at 3 a.m., right?
Yeah.
Or whatever. So I know what you mean. There's a whole kind of, to be really effective and to move fast actually needs massive infrastructure.
Yeah.
And like really, really good planning and really, really great execution. So it's never as easy or quick as you think it is. Particularly for a lot of these older companies where it's 15 different systems cobbled together.
You've talked about the back end before, and that never occurred to me how complicated that makes things when you're doing or trying to use the system to protect yourself the systems. And if you take this full circle back to offline casinos, this is where offline operators will get a bit upset, because if you walk into any UK casino now with, let's say, £3,000 and stick it on the table and say, give me chips for that, I think it's fair to say there's not one where you'd be able to straight away. There'd be an interaction would take place. Someone would pull you to one side, and I mean, once you get past €2,000, there's a mandatory requirement to get your ID. But with affordability in mind and with the fines that have been levied in mind, no one's going to let you play that money without a bit of backup. And that's obviously because it's a different environment where you've got human eyes watching what goes on. That's what would frustrate. That's why the offline sector, or one of the examples of why the offline sector feels they deserve a bit of liberation in the white paper, because we, as a sector, have been doing that for a good long while now. You know, the days of walking in with a plastic bag with 50 grand in it are long, long gone. Whereas it's feasible, for whether it's technical reasons or whether it's a compliance approach, if it's feasible to do that online, that just isn't fair. It might be difficult to stop, but it's still not fair between the two sectors.
It's a very fair and reasonable comment. Paul, I'm sure we have had the conversation about Kevin Costner, haven't we?
We have not.
I just bring it up because
whole field of dreams reference earlier on.
Yeah, he totally did. Well, that's true. Yeah. Totally did.
Slip that one in. Yeah. But yeah, the it was Major League he was in, wasn't it? As well as Field of Dreams.
No, it was Bull Durham.
Bull Durham, I think so. Of course, yeah. Major League being Charlie Sheen, wasn't it? Bull Durham.
Tom Berenger, Wesley Snipes.
Yeah.
Pop quiz.
Tim Robbins. Yeah.
Yeah. Susan Sarandon.
Yeah, Bull Durham. Yeah, yes, together very much. But I'm a huge baseball fan, believe it or not, I still play. And having just forgotten the title, Bull Durham would be right up there for me as a Kevin Costner film. His character is the veteran who's playing a couple of levels below the major leagues, but he's been there. And it's just the scene where he's on the bus telling him about what it's like in the major league is absolutely fantastic. It really kind of speaks to me. But I also don't get all the hatred for Waterworld. I just don't think it's as bad as people think.
It's not. I mean, essentially, it's Mad Max 2 on water. And there is nothing bad about Mad Max 2.
Absolutely. Yeah.
For American viewers, that is Mad Max the Road Warrior.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it all got a bit complicated there.
That's John's dog, by the way, having some water.
That is my dog having some water. Just in case. I'm not sitting here licking myself.
Well,
if I could do that,
there would be no podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. If I could do that, this would be an OnlyFans, not a podcast.
Ooh, yeah. I still rate Waterworld. Do you know what? Talking about this, I've never seen Dances with Wolves. Thinking about it as well.
I'm quietly confident I've also not seen it. And odd as it sounds, because when that came out on video, I was working in a video shop.
Right.
But I mean, it was just rented all the time. And it's like, it's a 3-hour film. And on video, that's a hell of a commitment.
Yeah, take you half an hour to rewind it.
And I just never watched it.
They do say that Avatar was Dances with Wolves, but with blue people, Dances with Smurfs. So I feel like if I've seen Avatar, I've probably seen Dances with Wolves.
See, I've also not seen Avatar. I'm kind of railing against these films that are like 3 hours long. Like, I'm a huge Batman fan. Like, I learned to read with Batman comics, and I've been a lifelong Batman fan. I haven't seen the recent Batman film because screw you, I'm not giving you that much of my life. You should be paying me. Once you get over 2 hours, 20 minutes.
But it's probably the backlash, though, against TV series, because TV series are able to go into detail. Like, it's in-depth storytelling over a long period of time. But if you've watched a big box set of whatever series, then a 90-minute movie feels really basic, right?
Well, there is a solution to this. For Avatar 2, we were in Vegas when it was released, and we'd been there 5 or 6 days, so we were getting towards the kind of slowing down territory. Not that we have late nights particularly anymore anyway. But with Avatar 2 being 3 hours, 10 minutes, we were staying at Red Rock by then, or Red Rock Hotel and Casino. They have their own cinema there, and because it's kind of a locals resort, everything's pretty cheap. So it was $8 for a ticket, and I wasn't going to sit there and watch a 3-hour, 10-minute movie. So I watched the first half, checked what time it was, like 2:26, and walked out, and then went back the next day and watched the second half. That's the way to do it at $8 a go. It was rubbish. Well, it was utterly predictable and almost identical to the first one. So it was probably $16 wasted instead of $8, but at least it kept me arse from going numb.
Well, I see. You say 90 minutes can seem a bit short, but if a story is well told, then 90 minutes is perfect. It's one of the reasons why I love horror movies. They very, very rarely outstay their welcome. They're normally exactly as long as they need to be, with minimum fannying about, and there's very little that you can cut out of them, no pun intended. I watched a slasher movie the other night. It's got a hell of a reputation. and it was about 85 minutes, and it was a really intense 85 minutes. It was beautifully done. I mean, like, that sounds like a strange thing to say about a horror movie, but the central character in it was so incredibly well realized and so well performed that I was completely sold. I'm like, wherever you take me, we're good. Let's go there. It surprised me. It didn't outstay its welcome. Now I've got the sequel to look forward to. And the sequel's like nearly 2.5 hours. 2.5 hour slasher film. There's got to be a lot of flab in that. But by all accounts, it's fantastic.
Which film is this?
I don't know if I should say the name. It's an endorsement then.
Well,
I don't want to encourage people to watch trashy horror films.
Go on.
So the movie's called Terrifier, which is a terrible name, and it has a killer clown in it, but the guy playing the clown, Art the Clown, he's just phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And it this is going to sound really dumb, just bear with me. They did something in that movie that genuinely really surprised me, and that doesn't happen terribly often. It's a slasher film, so you expect a certain amount of relatively predictable violence. But there is a point in the movie where the main character, homicidal killer clown with big knives and other terrible devices, he just suddenly gets this really pissed off look on his face and pulls a gun. And I'm like, I was not expecting that. That is actually the last thing that I would have expected in a movie like this. Fantastic. That's somebody who knows that the people that are sitting there watching that movie, they know what they're familiar with. They know what they're kind of expecting. They have a certain expectation in ways it's going to go. It just takes all that and it says, you don't know what's coming.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that attitude, and I love that sort of confidence.
It's a bit like the podcast, really, isn't it? You just don't know what's coming.
It is quite similar. We've never discussed donuts on this podcast, though.
Oh, I like a donut.
I love a good donut. There's a place in Ludlow called Walton's. There's like this fancy bakers in Ludlow, and they all do a great job. They really do a wonderful job. Walton's is where most of the local people go because, you know, it doesn't cost you a fiver for a loaf of bread.
Oh, artisan.
Yeah, putting the anal into artisanal. Walton's Donuts, the thing about Walton's Donuts is they're fresh every day, and the students have discovered them now, so they're all gone by like 10 o'clock. They're fresh done every day, and they are slightly undercooked.
Okay.
So they've got a sort of a doughiness, which is just so pleasing.
Doughy donuts, what will I think of next?
Well, mostly they're cooked to perfection. Right. But actually, these just, they have this wonderful point of difference, and it completely changes the flavor of the donut. They're really good donuts.
But I thought you were carnivore or something. Sure.
Yeah, I am. But that doesn't mean I don't have memories of food like that, because that's one of my all-time favorite things, is a Walton's donut.
That's what you'd stray from the path of, or is it okay?
It's one of those things where when I was developing my healthy relationship with sugar, I might have a bag of six of.
Oh, easily. Yeah, I could definitely see that.
That's not great.
I could polish that off easily.
If you're very, very lucky, Fintan, I might see if I can get some, and I'll bring them to you while you're racing Snowdonia.
That would be brilliant.
if you go past me quickly, I'll just throw them at you. I'll just one at a time. Keep fit and open wide. Funny. It'd be great.
You'd be near the end. The sugar crash should be fairly severe, I expect. If you've got 2 hours to go and put away half a dozen donuts.
That's a good share, actually.
Be off my tits on caffeine gels. It'll be fine.
Be some stodgy carbs in there. But it should arrest the diarrhea, hopefully.
Or accelerate it. As usually what happens.
Good times. Luckily, listeners, Fintan doesn't like talking about his races.
No, I never bring it up. Never bring it up.
Luckily, I do regularly. Paul Scalfa, I just want to say thank you for your patronage of the podcast. This, having you on as a guest again, it's not an indulgent thing at all. It's It's recognizing, well, what we like to do, recognizing when somebody is an expert in their field and getting them to come on and be an expert, basically.
Yep, that's what we
like. And mad props for bigging up Waterworld. I mean, like Art the Clown pulling a gun, that has surprised me.
Well, Jan Triplehorn as well. What a legend and great name.
Yeah, she does seem nice, doesn't she? She was actually, I would say, she was the very best thing about Basic Instinct. She's a tremendous actress. And of course, was with Bill Paxton in Big Love.
Basic Instinct, was she the partner?
No, that was George Zunder. He's a short, fat guy.
No, so familiar with the actual partner, but she was a couple, wasn't she? I can't remember.
She was Michael Douglas's wife, if I remember correctly.
Possibly ex-wife.
Yeah, yeah. Paul Verhoeven, underrated
Sliding
filmmaker.
Doors as well?
Ooh, yeah, yeah, I think you're right. There's a movie I've scrubbed from my mind. That was my Sliding Doors moment, deciding not to remember that film.
Yeah, best thing about it was, what's name's accent? Gwyneth Paltrow, wasn't it? She did a fantastic British accent, and that was the only good thing about it for me.
Be very, very careful. Don't diss Gwyneth in front of Fenton.
Oh, no, I'm saying fantastic accent.
He's a premium member of Goop.
I am. I got the candle and everything.
Apparently, do you do regular steaming of orifices?
Yep. Yep.
Fenton, actually, he gets that candle, but it's on a subscription deal.
I put it on when we do the podcast. Just to...
just to get in the mood.
Well, that's what curled the hair. Jeez.
My secret revealed.
Dear, oh dear.
Hair salons up and down Europe are going out of business as we speak.
Yes. That's one simple trick.
Barbers hate him.
We just became literally clickbait.
They see me walking, they go, oh no.
Yeah. Good. Cheers, Dave. We got a job on.
This isn't a 5 quid cut.
Yeah. Paul Scuffer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank
Paul
you.
No worries, represents Gaming Recruitment Solutions. That's Gaming Recruitment Solutions on the website grs-recruit.com, and it is a hyphen. If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.